This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, concerns for the health of the Ambai Islanders in Vanuatu, forced out of their homes by volcanic ash. Australia's foreign minister gives the ABC a nudge on the question of shortwave, and Pacific Island players call for an overhaul of the voting system at World Rugby's top table.
It's an education process, it's a slow burner. We're in this for the long run, but it does feel like we're getting somewhere now.
More from Dan Leo, founder of Pacific Rugby Players Welfare, later in the programme. But first, the topic of police brutality has hit the headlines again in Papua New Guinea after a video showing two officers apparently beating up a teenage boy in the province of West New Britain was posted on social media. The boy, who was suspected of being part of a group who robbed a woman in the town of Kimbe, has since appeared in court. But nevertheless, the brutal treatment he received from the officers who arrested him has been widely condemned. Since the video was made public, those officers have been suspended, pending the outcome of an internal investigation. Bethany Harriman reports.
Police in West New Britain province say they had nothing to do with the beating of this crying boy, who is begging the officers assaulting him to stop. The three-minute video has gone viral on social media, drawing condemnation from the PNG public, international human rights groups, PNG MPs, and Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister, Julie Bishop. Now the West New Britain police want to clear their name. The provincial commander, John Middy, says the Year 3 student was beaten by two armed officers dispatched from Port Moresby.
Just here to help us out to do some work in Kimbe and Moresby Bay, so they're already on their way back to Moresby now. To be honest, I was quite shocked too with the video.
The PNG Police Internal Investigation Unit have been made aware of the incident after seeing a statement from Police Commissioner Gary Buckey. The head of the unit, Chief Superintendent Robert Ali, says the two officers in the video will remain suspended pending the outcome of the official inquiry.
Unprofessional. And these are the sort of actions that tarnishes the reputation of the organization. We are doing everything we can to eradicate this minority group. This organization has no place for this sort of behavior.
Police Commissioner Gary Buckey admits it was he who sent the police officers from the capital to Kimbe.
Yes, I've deployed a unit for special operations in West New Britain for various reasons. Whether those police officers are involved in this beating or not, I don't know.
Commander Buckey says the officers in the video will be dealt with.
I condemn it. Okay, any police brutality, any police behavior that comes to the attention of members of the public, then report to the police commissioner. Commissioner gives attention to get it investigated.
Papua New Guinea's Attorney General David Stevens has also commented on the video, saying it shows an ever-existing problem in the PNG police.
It shows a bigger picture of a systematic problem, a cultural issue that we face as a country.
The PNG police have released a statement saying it was members of the Airborne Tactical Unit from Port Moresby who were responsible for assaulting the 15-year-old boy. The statement adds that the AUT officers were in West New Britain to assist local police in dealing with a recent upsurge in crime.
That report compiled by Bethany Harriman in Port Moresby. With me now is Caroline Terriman from ABC Radio Australia's Talk Piston program. And Caroline, it's interesting, we heard at the end of Bethany's report there that essentially the ATU officers from Moresby are being blamed for this apparent attack on this young boy. The West New Britain police seem to be going to great lengths to distance themselves from it, saying it wasn't us, it was them. Shouldn't the police be accepting responsibility for this collectively?
Well, that's right. The Papua New Guinea police does not have a very good name when it comes to abuse of ordinary citizens in Papua New Guinea. So for one set of police officers from one province saying it was them, the issue of police brutality covers the whole force. Mud sticks, unfortunately. So people, when they see the police, they don't have much belief in them that they are there to protect them.
Do you get any sense that perhaps the local force, the West New Britain force, felt powerless to act or felt that it wasn't appropriate for them to act because the officers who were apparently responsible came from Moresby?
That could be true. But, you know, when I spoke with the governor of West New Britain, he did say that police personnel from Port Moresby went there because of the increasing crime crime rate. Maybe the West New Britain police just let these police from Port Moresby to do their job, because after all, they went there to try and help West New Britain police. But I don't know how they divvied up their job there.
And we have an interesting situation here too, because Police Commissioner Gary Barkey, who has admitted that he deployed these guys to West New Britain who were caught in this video. But for him, he's originally from West New Britain, so this case must really strike a chord, you would think.
I'm sure that his people won't be happy with him. But it is a tricky situation, because the governor has admitted that the law and order situation with the youth is getting out of hand and they just don't know how to deal with it, hence them asking for support. And unfortunately, this incident has occurred.
But when they asked for support, presumably this wasn't what they had in mind, because whatever work the West New Britain force have put in up until now has surely been seriously undone.
That's right. So some people are saying, even the governor, that they recruit educated or highly educated people when they're recruiting young men and women to join the police force or even in the defense force, because the defense force also does not have a good name when it comes to human rights abuses, because they too, just last weekend, a soldier died because of trouble that they caused in a suburb of Port Moresby. So there have been calls for people joining the security forces to be not just picking people who leave maybe year 10 to join the police force. And the hope there is that if they are highly educated, they would understand the law and treat people with dignity.
Caroline, thank you very much. That's Caroline Turriman from ABC Radio Australia's Top Business Program with us here on Pacific Review. I'm Richard Hewitt. Now to Vanuatu, where it's expected the evacuation of Ambai will be completed this weekend, with more than 10,000 people forced to leave as ash from the Manara volcano continues to devastate their island home. But while the focus now is on the immediate emergency and finding safe new homes for the evacuees, there are long-term concerns over how much damage the ash clouds may have done to the islanders' health. And as Lauren Beldy reports, researchers have already started looking for answers.
Looking at photos of Ambai Island blanketed in grey ash, it's not hard to imagine the immediate impact of the Manara volcano's recent eruptions. But longer term, it may be harder to guess. Craig Miller is a volcano geophysicist with New Zealand research firm GNS Science. They have a team on Ambai who are investigating some of the effects of the eruption.
The impacts that we're looking on in terms of quality of water supply, a lot of the villages there rely on rainfall water from roofs, and if that is contaminated by ash, ash can get into the water supply, and then certain elements in the ash can leach out into the water supply and contaminate that.
Among the biggest health concerns is the possible impact of breathing in the ash or particulate in the air. Heather Handley is an associate professor in volcanology and geochemistry at Macquarie University.
Volcanic ash is not like the ash that you get from a fire that would crumble in your fingers and is very soft. This volcanic ash from a volcano is where we fragment a rock into tiny, tiny particles that are very sharp and jagged. That ash can travel a long way in the atmosphere and it can fall back down to the earth. And when it does, that ash can be inhaled by people or livestock, and these jagged ash particles can be very damaging to people's lungs. So they can cause asphyxiation, or in the worst case scenario, it could lead to silicosis and chronic lung disease.
There have been relatively few studies into the long-term effects of breathing in volcanic ash, and they've differed in their conclusions. Some found little to suggest that being near a volcanic eruption significantly increased the risk of chronic lung disease, but others have urged caution. Iceland's Eyjafjallajökull volcano. It erupted spectacularly in 2010, grounding flights across Europe and causing the evacuation of about 800 people. A study into the ongoing effects 3 years later found people who were exposed to the ash cloud were still more likely to have breathing problems than those who weren't. Dr. Handley says the amount of time people are exposed to the ash and the type of particles involved play a part in determining what the chronic effects, if any, might be.
It's really hard to put a time frame on what the length scale of volcanic activity you're looking at to get these effects. It also can depend on the composition of the material that's been erupted by the volcano. So we kind of measure the composition based on its silica content. So low silica volcanoes like Hawaii, and I think also Ambe is quite low silica, versus high silica ones, which lead to these really explosive volcanic eruptions and big paracaustic flows, deadly hot flows that we see. So it's hard to say because it depends on the composition, but it also depends on the time scale and the magnitude, so the volume of material erupted.
So worrying times ahead for the people of Ambae, as if being forced from their homes wasn't bad enough. For Dr. Heather Hanley from Macquarie University there, ending that report from Lauren Beldy. Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister Julie Bishop says she would encourage the ABC to broadcast radio via shortwave into the Pacific. Her remarks come amid a flurry of submissions to a government review of Australian media services in the region. The ABC switched off its shortwave service in January last year, in a move that's been widely criticised ever since, with Vanuatu's Prime Minister Shalo Salwai telling Canberra that cutting the service could cost lives during times of natural disasters. But as Bill Bainbridge reports, Ms. Bishop says Australia is committed to assisting the Pacific with emergency broadcasting.
Speaking from Samoa, Julie Bishop was sure to leave no doubt who had ended the ABC's shortwave broadcast.
We did not support the ABC closing its shortwave radio transmissions into the Pacific. That was not a decision of the Australian government.
The ABC ended the service in the wake of a sizeable funding cut following the election of the Abbott government in late 2013. ABC management argued the technology was old, expensive, and served only a limited audience. But it's come under sustained criticism, with crossbench senators demanding the government revisit the decision through a review of Australian broadcasting services in the Asia Pacific. That review's submissions closed last week. Foreign Minister Bishop made it clear she believes shortwave is still relevant.
I would certainly encourage the ABC to continue shortwave transmission in the Pacific.
But she didn't indicate whether the government would provide any specific funding to reinstate the service. Australia has provided funding to help keep Samoa's national broadcaster, 2AP, on the air. Jo Elsom is the head of the ABC's international development arm. She's in Samoa for the launch of a project to build a new transmitter for 2AP.
The existing transmitter is coming towards the end of its life and it does need replacing. So without it, Radio 2AP wouldn't be on air.
She says the service is vital.
If you speak to people in Samoa, they feel that Radio 2AP has an absolutely vital role, and that is in disaster communication. So the transmission tower and Radio 2AP is the main source of information for people across Samoa and also in a group of outlying islands for information about disasters. So when there is a disaster coming, everyone tunes in to 2AP in order to get information about that cyclone, for example.
And the service goes beyond natural disasters to keep Samoans connected to the daily business of their parliament.
And by law here, parliament must be broadcast when it's sitting. So as well as the disaster communications role, which is the primary focus and obviously the life-saving focus, the other really important role is broadcasting parliament to the people.
That's Jo Elsom, head of international development for the ABC, ending that report from Bill Bainbridge. The campaign group Pacific Rugby Players Welfare has launched a social media drive with the hashtag Seats at the Table, calling for the Pacific Islands to have far greater representation on the World Rugby Council. As it stands, the island's influence at the top table is limited to a share of Oceania Rugby's 2 votes, with that umbrella organisation also representing the interests of New Zealand and Australia. The founder and chief executive of Pacific Rugby Players Welfare, Dan Leo, is in no doubt, though, that the Pacific unions are not getting a fair deal from World Rugby.
We'd like to see a reform of the whole system. In some cases, you've got countries that have got 3 full votes and wield up to 10% influence on their board. And then you've got the Pacific Islands who have got 0.3%. We'd like to see a fairer model in line with what FIFA operates. We're not saying that it should be a one country, one vote system just at this moment. But our suggestion would be that World Rugby Council membership and weighting is probably based on World Cup qualification.
Leo says that wouldn't be a one country, one vote system, not immediately anyway. But World Rugby would argue that such a capture system, at least in part, already exists. They describe it as a clear, transparent and fair pathway. But World Cup qualification is just one of the criteria, and critics argue that when it comes to matters of finance and governance, the rules are weighted against the Pacific Unions. However, despite Prime Minister Tuilepi Salele telling the world only months ago that the Samoan Rugby Union was bankrupt, Chief Executive Vincent Fapuliai says they've managed to jump through those world rugby hoops.
Absolutely. We've hopefully ticked the boxes around all the criteria that World Rugby has set for the Free Pacific Island Unions, and we are just going through that process to prepare our application for seat in council.
And the Chief Executive of the Rugby Players Association, Aidan Clark, says the SRU is in that position as the result of a lot of hard effort.
Vincent's done some fantastic work, the whole overhaul of SRU governance, which is going to be great for the game, not only at the community level on the islands, but also internationally and for the Manu Samoan Sevens teams. So they should be congratulated on that. And they're going to earn that seat on there by merit, not through a campaign.
And after Oceania Rugby's annual review in Sydney this week, it appears Fiji are also on target for a council seat. So against that background, what does Vincent Fapuliai make of the PRPW's social media crusade?
Daniel Leo, we've engaged with him and wish him well on his campaign, but definitely Samoa Rugby Union, we have our own representative that look after the welfare of our players.
And that means the Rugby Players Association, but CEO Aidan Clark says Dan Leo's organisation have a case in terms of what it takes to win a vote on the World Rugby Council.
From a World Rugby perspective, I suppose they're asking to try and keep the integrity of the game of the people who have those seats. Whether that's right or wrong, I think they've got a good point in terms of it possibly needs to be revisited. But at this stage, I think Samoa, Fiji and Tonga are taking the stance that they just need to get up to the bar. For us to have these issues discussed on that front, it's really good. What we've got to be careful of is sometimes a social media campaign can be detrimental to the process.
However, that process still leaves the Pacific Islands short on power, even if they do each secure a precious vote among the game's decision makers. And Dan Leo says that's why he and the 500 members of Pacific Rugby Players Welfare intend to keep banging the drum.
There was a time where these types of stories only got picked up during the World Cup and when Samoa Fiji played England at Twickenham. Now we're getting a lot more pickup of these types of stories throughout the year. So that's testament to how far we've come. We really want to step that up and really achieve fairness and equity for the Pacific Islands. But it's an education process. It's a slow burner. We're in this for the long run, but it does feel like we're getting somewhere now.
Former Manu Samoa International and Chief Executive of Pacific Rugby Players Welfare, Dan Leo. And you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt. Young gun Hoago Paul Oya from Papua New Guinea is moving closer to his dream of becoming a professional Australian rules footballer after signing with the Gold Coast Suns Development Academy for another 2 years. Nicknamed Ace, he caught the recruiter's attention playing for the PNG Mosquitoes during their winning run at the AFL International Cup in Melbourne last year. As Bindi Bryce reports, Ace is among a handful of young players with Pacific heritage making strides towards the senior AFL ranks.
Hoago Oya received a hearty round of applause from his Gold Coast teammates last month as the youngster from Port Moresby was introduced to the Suns senior group.
Ace is our international scholarship holder from PNG. He's part of our academy. He moved out of here at the start of the year and he represented the Queensland team number 16 last year, so he's pretty excited. So he gets to train with you boys tonight.
The 17-year-old is continuing on his journey to professional football after going through the Queensland development system. As well as playing with the Gold Coast Reserves team, who compete in the semi-professional NEAFL, Northeast Australian Football League, Oya is also training with the senior AFL squad once a week. The AFL's development manager for the South Pacific, Ben Drew, says Oya is thriving on the field and in the classroom.
When he first came down last year and started staying down the coast as part of the talent pathway when he was in the Queensland team, he struggled early. And then his brother, Apex, came down, his older brother, so he spent a little bit of time down there, which really helped Ace to adjust, and now Apex is back home in PNG, but it's helped Ace work his way through and get comfortable in the host family where he's staying, and now he's really flourishing, which is really exciting and going really well at school.
Oya is too young to be drafted this year, but will be eligible for the 2019 draft. He will spend the next year as a player in the Gold Coast Development Academy, with the Suns maintaining rights to pick him up before other clubs. The small but skillful forward is off to a good start. In his debut NEAFL match, he helped the Suns to a 2-point victory over the Greater Western Sydney Giants Reserves.
Fight, fight, fight till we hold up the cup. Run, run, run.
Ben Drew says the match was a milestone for AFL in PNG because Oya was not the only young gun with Melanesian heritage on the field. Emmanuel Baru from Townsville also played with the Suns, while Melbourne-raised Aiden Bonner, who was drafted to GWS last year, ran out for the Giants.
It's really exciting for PNG. We had three Papua New Guinea boys playing in that match. There was obviously Ace playing for the Suns. There was a young boy, Emmanuel Baru, playing for the Suns as well, and he's a year older. And then there was Aiden Bonner, who was drafted to GWS last year. We had three young men playing in that netball match, which I don't think's happened before. There's a big wave of boys and girls, youth boys and youth girls coming through in PNG who are doing fantastically well.
And Ben Drew is confident more talented footy players from PNG and the rest of the Pacific will make their mark in the coming years.
That's the dream, isn't it? Providing opportunities for them to come and play. You know, the males and the females. We just need to get the right ones in front of the right people who can ensure that they keep them in the pathway.
Huge kick in the context of this game. After the halftime siren.
That's the confidence.
Ace kicks the goal and Papua New Guinea go to the break in front.
Bindi Bryce reporting, and we wish Ace every success in his sporting ambitions. And finally, this week marked 76 years since the Battle of Guadalcanal in Solomon Islands, a confrontation which history suggests was a turning point in the Second World War, as Allied forces brought Japan's march across the Pacific to a halt. But while the battle has been widely written about over the decades since, the role of Solomon Islanders, portrayed as loyal and trusty helpers to the Allies, has been less well documented. But as Evan Wasuka reports, a new book just launched in Honiara has set out to change the narrative.
The Battle of Guadalcanal lasted from the 7th of August 1942 to the 9th of February 1943. At the end of 6 months, the number of dead reached over 26,000 from both sides. Although the costs were high, the battle was a strategic win for the Allied forces, says Sir Bruce Saunders of the Solomon Islands Scouts and Coast Watchers Trust.
The US military made quite clear that if it wasn't for the Solomon Scouts and Coast Watchers, there would be no victory in Guadalcanal, and then went on to say if there was no victory in Guadalcanal, there'd be no victory in the Pacific. So it's significant.
For writer Annie Kwai, what's missing from the historical accounts is the role of Solomon Islanders in the war effort.
To simply say that Solomon Islanders are loyal helpers is to disregard the fact that there are Solomon Islanders that actively served in what then was known as the British Solomon Islands Defence Force and the South Pacific Service Battalion. So those military units that Solomon Islanders served under, and they actively were part of the war. So to say that they're just loyal helpers, which until the book was the common narrative, is just to disregard the fact that they did actively participate in the war.
For Ms. Kwai, her book, Solomon Islanders in World War II, An Indigenous Perspective, is about teaching young Solomon Islanders their own history and giving them pride about their accomplishments during the war.
Well, I hope that the Ministry of Education can take this book on board and integrate it into the school's curriculum. This is because the history that is currently taught in schools is about elsewhere. It's about things that are not so relevant to us as, you know, in taking a comparative stance on the story that the book is telling. But also, it is my intention that any Solomon Islander can download it for free online and read it, and it's more of an educational tool.
It becomes a book that every secondary school child would read and understand the stories.
Since 2011, the Solomon Islands Scouts and Coast Watchers Trust has been working towards gaining recognition for Solomon Islanders who took part in the war effort. Along with a memorial service and wreath laying, there will also be a special acknowledgement for Solomon Islanders in today's ceremony.
The Australian High Commission will then present the medallions that they have had cut for thanking the descendants of Solomon Scouts and any Coast Watcher families who served during the war. This began in 2011. They did this, and every year we give out medallions to these families to honour their grandparents who were grandfathers who supported Solomon Scouts during that Guadalcanal campaign.
The Solomon Islands Scouts and Coast Watchers Trust also believes that the book should be distributed to all students across the country. While this may not be possible just yet, free ebook copies can be downloaded from the website of the book publisher, the Australian National University Press.
The reporter there was Evan Wasuka, and while you're downloading, don't forget to sign up to the Pacific Review podcast so you can listen to some of the major stories from the region on demand. For now, though, that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Richard Ewart, and as always, thank you for listening.